Hello and welcome to another one of these episodes of Challenger Cities with me, Ian Montgomery. This episode is really, really fun because instead of me reaching out to somebody to be the guest on one of these things, I had somebody get in touch with me. So this is Rick Adamski. He's American. He runs a film called Ash and Lime. And we got chatting after one of the previous episodes I posted. I think it was the one with Mary Rowe. I thought it'd be really fun to do something with somebody who comes from, he's from Chicago, he's lived in different parts of the US, and then he now lives in Texas. And he has all these amazing stories of places in Texas, whether they're small towns like Grand Prairie, whether they're sort of suburbs like sort of DeSoto, or whether they're sort of more hipster kind of neighborhoods like Deep Ellum. And I thought it was just really interesting to get that perspective of an urbanist who sees the world through the context of how do we make this work for our unique context? Because you can't just say, hey, we're going to turn Texas into something like Amsterdam or Paris or Tokyo, because that just doesn't work and it just upsets people. So I really love this episode from the context of somebody who is very thoughtful about how they make places work in better ways that are representative of their people and their communities and their assets. Having spent only a little bit of time in Texas, I know some of these places, there's other places I don't know, some of them I've been to before I met Rick, and I just think it's great to sort of see how these things develop and how you create great places without following the usual cliched urbanism tropes. So without further ado, here is an episode with Rick Adamski. So the best way to start these things is, Rick, like, you found me rather than me finding you, and then we had a chat and I was like, oh, this guy's good, we should do a podcast. But tell us a little bit about you, man from Chicago, now in sort of the Dallas area, working as an architect. Like, give us the Rick story.
Sure. I'm originally from multiple places in the Midwest, but I ended up moving back and forth multiple times to Chicago, to Cincinnati. I lived in Michigan, was in Ann Arbor, Michigan for a while. I guess part of the context is that I maybe grew up in something a little bit different than the traditional American experience, you know, where even as a little kid, I was living in, you know, the Hyde Park Square neighborhood in Cincinnati, you know, a half a block from my school where I walked to elementary school, but also, you know, could walk to the Grater's Ice Cream, the best ice cream on earth, and the candy shop, and knew a lot of, you know, if I misbehaved, someone was yelling out of their house at me and telling my mother. You know, it was like a very different experience than maybe most people under the age of 50 have had growing up in, mm-hmm. in a U.S. city. And then, you know, even ended up living in Chicago in, you know, places like Lake Point Tower, which was, you know, at the time the tallest residential building in the world, right? So I had this like variety of experiences, both living in Cincinnati, living in Chicago, going to high school for a few years in Park, Illinois, which is known for Frank Lloyd Wright houses, but is also, you know, you jump on the train and you're in Chicago, and it's this, you know, just really nice place, maybe that I didn't fully appreciate at the time. So I kind of grew up in these places that were a little bit different, and that was just very natural for me, and ended up choosing to live in places that were, you know, kind of a little bit different, whether it was in Ann Arbor, whether it was in like the university neighborhood in, you know, Clifton and Cincinnati, and then moving back to Chicago, right? So I kind of had a little bit different experience. And I had also what I now understand in retrospect to be an extreme attraction to what we might call third places. So places where you can kind of see and be seen, where you can connect with other people, where, you know, conversation is the main activity. I ended up finding and seeking out those places a lot. And so that, again, ended up being kind of the air that I breathed. And I didn't realize maybe until recently how much it affected the way that I looked at cities and the way that I looked at places and so forth. Long story short, I ended up going to University of Cincinnati, did not go to planning school there, unfortunately. Didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. But several years later, I was literally sitting in a car with my wife at the time, with my stepfather, with my mother. And my stepfather just said, you should study urban planning. And everyone, it was like, yes, that's what Rick did. It was like, this was 18 years ago, maybe, you know, something like that. Like, it was a long time ago. I have never questioned it since. I've never questioned it since then, not once. That's a great decision to be doing in my life. Yeah. And because these were issues that I already thought about, you know, I was always thinking about these ways. How can we creatively reuse space? You know, you've got this old warehouse. How could we think about it? And so everybody agreed to that, and I haven't looked back since then. So I ended up, you know, working in Chicago, worked for some of these really amazing organizations. You know, the Congress for the New Urbanism, the CNU, was headquartered in Chicago at the time. And I got to work on the Freeways Without Futures campaign. And the American Planning Association was in Chicago. And I worked for the Planning Advisory Service. So I got to do all this great research. And then Center for Neighborhood Technology, which, of course, is known for the Housing and Transportation Affordability Index. And I got to work on that and did all this amazing stuff. But I also had graduated in 2009, which I wouldn't recommend. So I ended up moving.
So did I.
Well, yeah. So you know how it is. So I ended up, you know, just for work, moving to Texas and moving to Fort Worth and meeting a lot of people who really changed the way that I looked at cities and planning, both in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And I started going at the time, the year before I left for Texas, I started going to these Congress for the New Urbanism conferences and meeting all of these people who were very like-minded, who are maybe a little bit different than the stereotype that a lot of people have of the CNU, because I think a lot of people think Seaside, Florida and Greenfields and that part of it. But, you know, the other part of it is, are these people who work on this very grassroots level, you know, and have a very different take on places. So I started meeting with both types of people, so to speak, and I started to have more of a, what we might call a bottom-up grassroots incremental way of thinking about places and about planning. And, you know, it was like when I was working at the city of Fort Worth, right? Like, because I was all, you know, reading all these books and involved in all this and thinking I was more of an expert than I was, as you know, as beginners can do, right? Thinking that I knew everything when I would say I probably had as much confidence in my knowledge of planning in 2000 as I do today, you know, that type of thing. You learn what you don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm going to this, so this neighborhood Race Street, right? This was, gosh, you know, 12, 13 years ago. I'm going to this thing and there's, you know, I had seen this guy, Jason Roberts, and he had this thing, Better Block. So we're doing this Better Block on Race Street. And for if any of your listeners don't know, it's, think of it as a demonstration project. So it's like you have, you know, you've got the street, Race Street, and it's like, well, there's these great buildings here, but there's not the type of activity that we might want. And there's not the type of streetscape improvements we might want. So let's put in some trees and show what it might be like. And let's fill in some of the storefronts with temporary businesses. And let, you know, so you're literally borrowing trees and plants and painting things and, you know, all sorts of stuff to demonstrate what's possible, right? The first project that we did as part of this was a neighborhood cleanup. And the neighborhood looked like, the street just looked like nobody loved it. But at the time, I couldn't have articulated why, right? All these organizations I worked for and all these books I read, I couldn't articulate why. And we go and get several pizzas and some, you know, 2 liters of soda or whatever. And there's a neighborhood cleanup. And like 2 hours later, it looks like people cared about the neighborhood. The trash was cleaned up and everything, you know, everything was the hedges were, you know, it was weeded, all of that stuff. And it looked like people cared about it, but you couldn't have articulated why.
You can only post-rationalize some of these things. Like pre-rationalizing it, it seems kind of obvious, but like,
yeah,
you can only really get the emotional buy-in to it once it's been done.
I mean, a lot of things seem obvious once you've figured them out.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like there's a lot of things in life that are like a lot of times to get to the bottom of something after you've waded through a bunch of things is actually pretty simple, right? It's like I read through, it was for about a 2-block downtown, if that, and they did a 330-page economic development analysis that basically said nothing. But if I gave you, if someone gave you a 1-page economic development analysis, then it says something, right? It has
constraints
to.
Are good.
Well, constraints are good, but also like you could throw a bunch of stuff out, but that's not actually what it means to understand something. To actually understand something, it comes to a simplicity, and you have to think about it a lot to come up with that simplicity. I'm sure if we did our research, right, just to give like an extreme example, right, I'm sure before Isaac Newton came out, like, well, in his time, I'm sure there was somebody who came up with 37 laws of motion, and you had to be the smartest mathematician in the land to even understand what they were talking about. And they were probably going, you know, in Cambridge and talking about their laws of motion. And this dude comes out with three laws of motion that you could explain to an eight-year-old, that the eight-year-old would go, well, yeah, isn't that obvious? And he changed the whole world with it, right? Like, yeah, you know, if you push against something, it pushes against you, duh. So, you know, the thing gets simple, and when we don't know what the heck we're talking about, we make them more complicated than they actually are.
Uh-huh.
And I think that to kind of, so you know, I think that that's kind of a broad thing, and I think that it's like a distinction that Chuck Marone from Strongtowns makes between complex and complicated. I don't know if you've heard that, but what he'll basically say is, you know, it's like a watch is complicated or an engine is complicated. Like, it has a lot of moving parts, but you know if you mess with one of the parts exactly what will happen, right? If you have a street, right, and you change what you're doing on a street, or if you change what you're doing in a downtown, it's complex. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you want to actually think very simply and do very simple things, because you don't really understand the consequences of everything that you're doing. Anyway, so going off of my tangent there, you know, this particular neighborhood, you had this like assessment of the neighborhood that had been done, and they went building by building, and it was like, okay, but what are you doing? And it turned out that the most transformative thing that could be done to start was to buy everybody pizza and clean up the street. Like, that was the first step. And it was the beginning of a realization that we have become what you might call too clever by half, right? It's like we're throwing out all of this nonsense, and we come up with plans that don't get implemented because they end up, to a large degree, and I don't want to be too, you know, I may be being too unfair, but to a large degree, it's like they're kind of blowing smoke. It's like, what do you need to do to actually get things done? What are the actual next steps? So when I was in Dallas, I'm meeting these people, and I'm not only am I meeting these new urbanists, but at the time, you know, when I started going to CNU, you had this guy, Chuck Marone, who starts showing up, and, you know, he had one part-time employee at the time besides him, and they had the Strongtowns idea, but it was very similar. And it was like, break things down into steps that you can actually handle, like get the long-term stuff done, right? But like, make it simple enough that you can do it and actually give people the tools that they need to do it. And you can have confidence in your own expertise, but still have the humility to understand that, like, look, like I'm just consulting with you. Like, I have to give you stuff that you can actually do. And it's so extreme, Ian, that when I was early on, and we did this report, and it was like 30 things that a city could do. And I gave it to the mayor, and I said, okay, here's like a strategy. And the mayor literally looked at me and said, well, we could do that. Like that's almost a negative that he could actually do something. And I'm like, you know, okay, give me $100,000. I'll come up with a report of things that you can't do. I don't mind doing that if you want to pay me the money. But that's how, you know, that's how warped it is. We overthink things, and we can see the results in the sort of return on investment that we get from spending a lot of money on cities and not getting the type of results that we want, that actually enhance the human experience, that actually create great places, that actually create places that people love and that help people thrive. So I'm working with, you know, I'm working in the city of Fort Worth, and I went to a conference in Louisville, Kentucky. That was what was then kind of known as like the CNU Next Gen Group, right? This was 11 years ago, or 11 and a half years ago. So I was still relatively one of the young people then. And these were people who were kind of relatively young generally, but who were also, more importantly, sort of on the cutting edge and trying to push the CNU in a better direction. And this was an invite-only conference. Give you an idea of how electric these conferences could be. The previous one had happened a few years before in New Orleans, and it's where these guys, Mike Leiden and Tony Garcia, said, hey, we've got this idea called tactical urbanism. Do you think it has legs? So, you know, it was tactical urbanism came from one of these, right? It's like you're talking with really like capable, innovative people. So we all did a presentation. Mine was actually about a storefront program that never ended up happening in downtown Dallas, but that they made happen on paper. We all did our presentations and they were all these very similar themes, right? It was all like some people were talking about specific things that happened. Some people were talking about broad concepts, but it was like, do what you can with the resources you have, involve people, focus on metrics, try something. And if it works, keep going, you know, find assets and filling gaps. Like I could summarize it very quickly into these ideas. And I was super electrified. And somebody who was from my region, I brought in actually a couple other people from my region. He turned to us and he said, we should start a business based on this. And I was either bold or foolish or crazy enough to actually do that. So for more than 11 years, I've been living self-employed as a consultant, working somewhat with developers, but mostly with cities, and working to help cities to focus on results and to focus on outcomes and to get the things done that they can do and to have a more results-oriented planning strategy. Which is an incredibly difficult way to make a living, but I've managed to do it so far. So I'll knock on wood for that.
You're surviving, man.
I've kept going at it and I've had some really great, you know, nobody bats 1,000, but I've had some amazing wins, you know, and to go to places and be like, wow, like all these people are enjoying something that I helped to make possible is extremely rewarding. So that's kind of where I am right now. It's been, you know, it's been a really cool journey. And I think that, you know, these times especially require this type of thinking. And, you know, and again, it's like, it's not cities. I figured this out during COVID, right? Cities are not very natural generally at pivoting. And they're not very natural at saying conditions have changed. And so we need to adjust based on the conditions. But, you know, we're at a point where cities are going to have to pivot, right? The way that things have been done, at least here in the United States, right? I'd guess cities probably have to think about pivoting a heck of a lot in Canada too.
They do, but they're not very good at it.
Right. Well, they're not very good here at it. And, you know, and probably in both cases, they need to say conditions are changing and we need to figure out what that means and how to think differently. And, you know, it's like there's no way cities can count on having the federal funding that they have been reliant on, the grants and everything else like that. I don't even know, like, I still can't tell you exactly how things are going to go down. Like, I have a better idea than I did 3 months ago, but like, this is still a very, very unpredictable situation. And so, you know, there's a need to pivot. And one of the things that this approach focuses on, this very bottom-up approach, is figuring out what can you do with the resources that you actually have that you can count on. You know, so don't assume that you're going to have the type of grants that you've had in the past. Some of them will probably come through. Some of them probably won't, but they could be cut any moment, right? So what do you actually have that you can count on? So, you know, in the case of Texas, for example, you have economic development money that will keep coming in as long as you have sales tax. You have a couple of different basic kinds of economic development corporations in Texas, one kind of which is more flexible than another. But, you know, you have a lot of places that's like you've got a ton of money coming in. You've got huge amounts of money coming in. And the way that you've chosen to use that money is by basically competing with your neighbors and having a race to the bottom over who can have the most giveaways so that you can get, you know, a warehouse to come into town. Right. And like that is like, or even like, hey, let's pay, you know, literally let's pay Chick-fil-A to come into town. Right. Let's pay Starbucks to come into town. Those sorts of things happen all the time. And the actual people who are the heart and soul of the community don't really get any love. Uh-huh. The great chicken place that's been there for 50 years in the heart of your downtown that people actually visit your city for, they're not going to get a penny. You know, that's just the way that it is. So, you know, how do we think a little bit more grassroots? How do we think more bottom up? And how do we learn how to rely more on ourselves? So, you know, it was in that vein that in addition to the stuff that I do with Ash and Lime, I do a lot of developer consultation. I do downtown plans that, you know, could be best described as action plans, right? Like, how do you get things done? We can do the long-term plan. We'll work with your goals and objectives, but like, let's stop this nonsense and let's figure out how to get something done in the next 3 months. We don't have time to overthink this, right? Especially now. But we also have this thing, the Storefront Renaissance League, which is a number of different kind of it's what you might describe as an umbrella organization. So it has a bunch of different consultants. But the idea is we can go into your downtown or to your, whatever it is, your commercial neighborhood, and we can help to find the tools and resources that you need in order to get things, to get your storefronts filled or to make your storefronts look better. So it's a tailored assessment, and, you know, we can bring in different types of people. It was co-founded by myself and this guy, Jaime Izarreta, who is the, you know, if you don't know him, for those who might not know, he literally wrote the book on storefronts. You know, he's the storefront mastery guy and the best expert I know of the subject. But I also have Marcy Goodwin, you know, who's working with us, and her, you know, Smart Start team, who are the best people who I know of how to go into a town and help to support the small businesses. We've got this Zero Empty Spaces organization that we're working for that helps to, you know, okay, you've got a vacant space. We're going to actually get artists in there at a low rate and help to bring some culture in, or, you know, the crowdfund better. Like, these are the best crowdfunding people I know, best incremental developers, right? So like really strong people, but who can be brought in, you know, strategically. So we can say, okay, here's what we're looking at. Here's our inventory. Here's our assessment. What do we need to do in order to get these storefronts filled? Are you in a strong position and we mainly need to get some code enforcement and get people to either fix their place and move up, or this is kind of, you kind of have a little bit of a ghost town situation on our hands. So let's go try to figure out one or two places where we can get started. Maybe we need to kind of give them a little bit of extra help, but we'll come up with a whole strategy, you know. And similarly, figuring out designs, we've got this guy, Monty Anderson, who I work very closely with, co-founder of Neighborhood Evolution and Incremental Development Alliance, you know, who's had enormous success both in his own developments and as a coach, and saying, okay, this is kind of an odd space. Let's figure out how we can subdivide it, do what's called a pro forma to see how we can make sure to make money at this, and let's make things happen. So we have a very diverse team that comes in. But it's basically, let's come in and let's solve this problem. And again, you know, we might have, you know, a rough period coming up probably in terms of municipal budgets. So how do we work within these budgets that might be unpredictable for a while, and figure out how to actually get something done? So at the very least, you can tell, you know, your constituents, if you're a city manager, if you're an economic development person, hey, we're giving it our best shot, and we're not just going to say, you know, we're not going to take care of our downtown for now because we don't have the grants. That's not a very sustainable position, you know.
In terms of like going about this, like when we chatted before, you told me like a couple of amazing little stories around, like, one was, I think, was a train station in Texarkana. One was like a Mexican sort of grocery store, bodega, taco place that become like a honeypot for bringing the community in. I love examples of these, of like, here's how you do these things really, really well, because they really matter. And yeah, so, they're kind of unsexy in some ways, but they're also the most heartwarming and compelling and attractive stories.
Here's what I would say, right? I would say that what we do, to say that it's unsexy, it's like, what we do is we have very grandiose means that we use to pursue very boring ends that are very unsatisfying. So a lot of things that look exciting on paper aren't actually exciting. You know, it's like, if you have like your big, you know, stadium, and we're going to have the stadium and it's going to bring all of these people into our downtown, or we're going to have this big convention center. And then it's like, okay, you build the stadium, you build the convention center, and then the area around it is a ghost town. Right? Like, so our convention center in downtown, when I first arrived in downtown Dallas, this was, you know, 2011, right? Like, we had already spent like $10 billion on the downtown, and you couldn't get a cup of coffee on a Sunday there, right? It's like we did all this stuff, and it was, you know, we needed to do asbestos, and we had a big convention there, but you couldn't get a cup of coffee on a Sunday. So it wasn't actually very exciting. So, you know, the way that we see it is, how can you work on the grassroots and help to support things that are just very exciting? So I'll give an example of in DeSoto, Texas, of a project that I worked on. And I also worked on it with this guy, Monty Anderson, who is the main developer there. But it's cool because I've gotten to experience this place from before it existed and evolved, as evolved. So this is a suburban strip shopping center that was on a very kind of nondescript, you know, thoroughfare, what we might call a strode, right? Now it's like just kind of a traffic passerby street. And what was then this very nondescript shopping center. And there was this big space that was known as the old Ace Hardware.
Uh-huh.
And when the city came to Monty about it, he was going to do, you know, he was basically going to put in a dollar store, not because he wanted to, but because that was the only thing that people were coming to him with interest on. So they said, okay, what can we do with this that's going to be more creative? And what he did and what I helped him with was to create the Grow DeSoto Marketplace, where under one roof, you could have a bunch of different businesses. So you have, you know, I think 8 micro restaurants and micro retail and, you know, all sorts of businesses that are under one roof. But you also have outdoor space. You also have gathering space and things like that. So now, and what would have been a dollar store, you have many, many small businesses, which, as it turned out, are about 95% Black owned, by the way. So it's basically an unofficial Black business incubator. But it also has indoor spaces and outdoor spaces that are spaces that people can use. So it's like that type of creative approach has been successful. And just, you know, it's like this isn't about throwing a ton of money into it. This is about throwing in creativity, seeing what's there and who's there, and what you can do with it. So, you know, another example is, you know, that's more of like a kind of a tactical urbanism project, we might say, that I've also gotten to experience. Sometimes when you see places that have been around a long time and you get to experience them, it's really cool. This was in the Deep Ellum neighborhood in Dallas, which is kind of the hipster neighborhood, you know.
I've been.
So you've been to Deep Ellum. Okay. So, you know, and at the time there wasn't really public space. So we did this thing that was like a 4-day, you know, demonstration project, like 96-hour demonstration project, day and night, where we shut down the space. We did basically a tactical urbanism project, had all sorts of events, had performances, had stages. And, you know, we were pushing at the time to pedestrianize it. So this was almost 10 years ago. So it hasn't ended up being pedestrianized at this point. But what we've seen is I come back, you know, they've still strung out lights there, and it's still being used as a space whenever there's markets and things like that. And the city has slowly started making infrastructure investments and putting it into bonds. And so we're seeing an evolution that came from that. Here's just a cool example of what happened. So at the time in Deep Ellum, I used to think it's kind of weird that there's no buskers here. Mm-hmm. When we did this pop-up thing, there were 2 stages. We had hired performers at different times. We had a little bit of budget for this. What we found is that when we didn't hire the performers, people would be waiting in line to perform. So they actually worked out things amongst themselves where it'd be like, okay, there's a line of people waiting, so we're going to perform. And what happened afterwards, I would go through and I saw that a busker culture, like a street performer culture, had developed in Deep Ellum. It's kind of gone away by now, but, you know, you had it for a long time that developed in the wake of this. You also had, after we left, you had a follow-up where they did a series of events that lasted for a whole month. Right. So you see this transformation where you start to have different relationships with public spaces and things like that. So we didn't actually hit a grand slam in the sense that we didn't get our objectives, at least yet. Right. The street wasn't shut down for cars, but we saw a lot of really positive transformations. And every time I go to the neighborhood, even to this day, I can experience things that we helped to transform and that we helped to push in a positive direction because of this. And I see a lot of that in, you know, stuff where I've worked or where I've done, you know, Grand Prairie, Texas. We did, you know, just some strategies for the downtown. One of the things that we helped with was this pop-up of a restaurant that's now called Firehouse Grand Prairie, you know, an old firehouse. And we have, you know, we helped to do not only where they had some stuff going on inside, but outside We helped to fabricate 50 items of furniture, brought in some games and toys and things like that. And we had a situation where they were actually serving alcohol, but they also had some other things going on. We experienced a place that we helped to create where you saw everyone from toddlers to the very elderly in the same place, all having a great time. You could have a little kid running around. You could have a teenager. You had young adults, older adults, and they were all having a great time at this wonderful place. And if you go there now, you know, again, it's something that we get to experience. We've seen it evolve where now you have coffee and booze and stuff like that, this, but you have this outdoor space that has these performances. So we worked on something that was, you know, 8 or 9 years ago that was basically a 2-day pop-up event, and we can come back and we can experience it. And that's so cool and so rewarding about the type of stuff we do.
So like you talk about Deep Ellum at the start of that, but like I went to Dallas about a year ago now. And I went to Dallas, I went to Fort Worth for work, and I was there without a car. So I got the train from Fort Worth over to Dallas. It was actually packed because there was a basketball game on. But my God, downtown Dallas, I was like, what have I walked into here on a Saturday afternoon? There's just nothing going. It's dead. It felt sad. And then I was like, I need some barbecue food. I need to cheer myself up. And I went to Deep Ellum. I was like, what's going on? Like, this is cool. There's like multiple barbecue places. There's nice shops. There's breweries. There's people wandering around and exploring. Like, it's so weird how, like, you're not very far away, but, like, the vibe of the city can just radically shift because somebody has given a shit about that place, whereas nobody really cares about downtown Dallas on a Saturday or Sunday.
Well, so first of all, how long ago was this that you were in Dallas?
A year ago.
Okay. So you actually have a part of downtown Dallas that's much more vibrant than it used to be, which is by AT&T Plaza now. And that's been a change. You know, I just moved my office from downtown, but I was working downtown for 7-8 years. And so to see that level of vibrancy where you can go on a Tuesday night and it's packed has been very different. You know, and you've had that in Fort Worth. If anything, Sundance Grand Fort Worth is in some ways struggling a little bit, maybe less than advertised. But that was, you know, when I moved to the area in 2011, downtown Fort Worth was, there was a lot of things you could do on a Saturday night, and downtown Dallas was a little bit more dead. So there's that area that's doing well, but you know, it's, I think that it's just hard. And I think that there was, you know, there's been over the last several years, new leadership came in, but then COVID happened. So that was a big blow for downtown Dallas. But I think it just didn't have that life in its culture. You know, it felt like, gosh, you've got this great, especially in 2011, it was like, you've got this great skyline. It looks like exciting from the distance, but it's not actually when you do it. And it's, and by the way, I know people who lived in downtown Dallas in 2003 who said that on a Saturday night in downtown Dallas, there were two places to eat. There was McDonald's and there was the French Room at the Adolphus Hotel. So, you know, it's improved, but I think that it had definitely a very, very hardcore day only vibe to it for a long time that's had to be changed. But yeah, you go into Deep Ellum and it's a lot, you know, it's adjacent and it's a lot more active. You also have a weird situation in Dallas where is in many ways more of a de facto downtown than downtown is.
Mm-hmm.
And like, for example, law firms have gradually moved to uptown in recent years, like over the last 8 years or so. But you have very high end office space and you also have a lot of walkability and things like that. And I think that there's been a bit of a feeling that, you know, businesses that we can go to uptown have the walkability and the mixed uses and things like that, but maybe not some of the headaches that might be associated with downtown is kind of the perception. So yeah, uptown Dallas is, I think maybe I've been told that Atlanta is kind of similar, but it might be the only place where you have like a de facto downtown that's walkable and that is a business mixed use hub that's adjacent to a downtown.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very, very unusual situation there.
There's a thing that you talk about, like to bring it back to that sort of complicated and complex thing, like that example in DeSoto, the examples that you talked about before in other like less downtown areas, but then also like the Deep Ellum example with Dallas. It's like not terribly complicated what you're doing, but it's in some ways it looks very, very simple. There's a magic to, you have to have the people in the community that give a shit and care and are going to go and create the commercial opportunities. You have to have the municipal leaders that are going to not get in the way and you can give them the confidence that this thing is going to, you don't exactly know how it's going to work out, but it's going to turn into something positive. And then it's just like, then it's like playing this enabling role. And I think so much of what happens in cities is like, we feel like we have to get the plan perfect. And then you make the perfect plan and then it all falls over, or you make the perfect plan and nothing ever gets started. But you're just setting the conditions of like, I've tended to the environment enough that good things can happen here. I think that's your magic.
Well, so a couple of things, like to work within, like to help to figure out what simple interventions can happen, you certainly have to do a lot of your homework, both as a professional and with regard to the specific place, right? And a lot of it ends up being that you're focusing on different types of work than would normally be done. So for example, you know, I think of New Braunfels, Texas, which is, this was like 4 years ago, 4.5 years ago. So this was, an example of something where somebody just gave me a budget and said, just write your scope. Like, this is what you need to do, just write your scope. And it was a really, the way that it was set up, it was a place where I was able to do it the way that I really wanted to, which is that we ended up not getting in the car for 4 days. I think we got into someone else's car one time and 3.5 days maybe. And we ended up walking around, and because of the way that it was set up, we could have breakfast there. We could have coffee there. We could have breakfast, and we could also close down the bars. Right? It's like, and so it's like we had a certain amount of meetings. We just immersed ourselves. We walked and walked and walked. The guy who was working with us is like, why are we walking? So why are we walking this way? I'm like, we're going to walk and we're going to understand this and we're going to talk to people and we're going to get what's going on. And so the type of information that you get is very specific, because if you're coming in with abstractions, you're not actually going to be able to get anything done, right? If I come in and abstractly say, oh, these three storefronts are perfectly positioned to blah, 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 it's like, okay, but have you talked to, Mr. Thomas? You know, all right, let's go have some beers with Mr. Thomas. Mr. Thomas ain't doing nothing with his properties. Like, and maybe he told me he is, but then someone else is going to tell me he's not going to do it, right? He's not doing it. So it's like, okay, this is a recommendation we can put down on paper, but this isn't actually how we can get things done. But, Linda around the corner, she doesn't have the best storefront, but if you give her some inspiration, she will set things on fire. She will do amazing stuff. So like that, the actual human beings who are there, and maybe she needs a little bit of these types of resources in order to get this done. Or you figure out, nothing is going to get done until we get this downtown association on the right path, because they're just having 2-hour complaint sessions. Let's figure out the steps to get these people to do this. And you start figuring out individual dynamic, who can be borrowed from, who is going to run with the ball, who is going to do things, who might just need some inspiration, like, hey, you've got this great place here, what if you did this and this? Or who might need a little bit of like, hey, you need to talk to the, you're doing amazing stuff here, but you're not getting bank loans for this or anything. You need to talk to the Small Business Development Center and tell them this and that. I will introduce them to you, because you're going to need these resources in order to take it to the next level. It's like, you have to talk with specific people and come up with specific strategies in order to get these types of things done. And that's the type of I think, research. And when we talk about the Storefront Renaissance League, right? Jaime, who co-founded it with me, was like, let's make it into a superhero league. And I was like, why do I feel uneasy about that? I'm like, oh, okay, I got it. Because are we going to be like the superheroes who sweep in and, got all these great superpowers and we're going to save your community for it? And, we've got great, the people we're working with are the best people I know of in the world to do this stuff. Like, we're working with amazing people. I love what we're working with. But we ain't going to be able to come in and save your community. Like, we're just consultants. We're going to be gone. So what are you going to do? So the way it was rephrased, and I think we're still working on the wording of it, is like, well, you're joining the league. Like, we're coming in. We're going to help you to find your superpowers so you can do amazing things. And that's our role. And so, like, what we have to leave behind is that. And that requires so much humility, right? Because, like, Ian, if I really do my job, if I go into a community and I help them to do things, and I've really done my job well, they're not really going to give me credit. not really. Like a little bit, maybe that consultant's great. But like, if I've really done my job, they're going to say correctly, hey, we did this thing. We all did this. This was our community. And, you know, I'm the developer. I did this amazing thing. And that developer is going to get the credit, you know, and we need certain things for our portfolio. But it's like, we can't make this about our egos.
I've always said this for consultants, like the best consultants take on this archetype of a golf caddy, a Sherpa, an assistant coach.
Yeah. Good
one. It's like the Sherpa never gets the credit, but like you don't get to the top of Everest without having the Sherpa.
I love that. I'm stealing that, Ian.
Please do. I think I might have borrowed it from somewhere and I can't remember where I borrowed it from.
But yeah, like, no one's going to be like, oh yeah, I got to the top of Everest, this great Sherpa. Like, who cares? You climbed Everest.
Nobody knows like the name of Tiger Woods' caddy, and I actually did know this and I've now forgotten it. But it's like, you get the same things in like English football, soccer, of like, there's managers that are amazing managers and they will get all the glory. And when they'll change teams, sometimes the assistant doesn't go with them. And they're nothing without the assistant that they had. That assistant often took the job that they become the head coach or the manager at wherever they were before, and they bomb because it's like it's a bit of a team thing. And like, to me, all the best consultants tend to be people that they actually couldn't do it, but they couldn't, if they were the ones running these businesses, they probably couldn't do it. But they're very good at spotting the things that people who are good at these businesses aren't so good at spotting and nudging them in the right direction. And I think that's the thing that like consultants need to get away from their ego, and like clients need to understand, how do I use my consultant? Because I'm not making them they take the shot for me, but they might be telling me which way the wind is blowing. I think that's the thing.
I love that.
So that to me is what you're doing, because it's like there's plenty of people in the world that can set up a coffee shop or a restaurant. There's plenty of people that can stop people setting up a coffee shop or a restaurant. And there's plenty of people that can be like, how do I connect the dots between, it's not just the physical serving of the coffee, it's having the right space, the right environment, the right conditions, the right street. How do I stumble upon it? I think that's there's a little bit of like alchemy and magic there that you're doing.
Yeah, I think that I like the way that you put that. I mean, I think that it's like, and I think kind of going, this kind of goes full circle a little bit back to complex versus complicated. So I was working with the city of Seguin, Texas, which is kind of close to San Antonio, between San Antonio and Austin, basically. It's a little bit off the highway, basically between San Antonio and Austin.
Driven that highway, never heard of it. Keep going.
It was off the highway, yeah. So, but it's a really cool town. And there was a couple block area, a block in particular that we felt should be pedestrianized. Right. And a lot of people had some concerns about taking away the parking spaces. I wasn't particularly concerned about it, but it's like a couple of things. First of all, it's like you need to have public support. So let's try this slowly so that we have public support. But also, let's learn from our mistakes, because we don't actually know what's going to happen. We think we know what's going to happen. But we're working within complex systems. And then if something's complicated, if you have the best, you know, mechanic in the world, and that person does something on the engine of a car, right? They know what's going, they know all the consequences. If something's wrong with the car, they know what's wrong. And if they change it, they know what they're going to do. If you have an engineer who builds a bridge and that engineer knows what they're doing, they know if like, okay, if you put a normal amount of pressure on this bridge, it's not going to collapse. Uh-huh. Right? If you build a road or you shut down a road or you pedestrianize a road, you actually don't know what's going to happen. So you think of a lot of times in the 80s and the 90s, we shut down all of these places and pedestrianized them. And in most cases, it ended up being a disaster, not because the people were necessarily incompetent who did it, but because they took a decisive thing that was permanent without testing it first to see what would actually happen and what adjustments needed to be made. So it's like, okay, so you're not sure what's going to happen if we shut down this street and we take away all these parking spaces. And you know what? I'm not either. Like, I think I know, but like, this is a complex system and it's my job to have some humility. So it's like, okay, so let's, you know, it becomes like, let's do some pavement treatments and let's do some public art and let's have some other sort of signals that indicate this, and then let's shut it down when we have special events and see what happens. And then we can say, okay, we're going to just shut it down for the weekend. We're going to shut it down for the week. And by the way, they shut down Broadway at Times Square doing that. They pedestrianized Times Square. Times Square. Those plans were started in 1969. There's no way, if I had any authority as an engineer, as a mayor, anybody else in New York City, there is no way, even thinking the way that I think, that I would say, let's just shut down Broadway at 42nd so that you don't have cars going through there forever. No way. That would be incredibly irresponsible. But to say, let's have a special event. We'll put out some chairs. We'll test it for the day. We'll see what happens. We'll look at what happens to the traffic, and then we'll talk to the merchants. You've doubled the business for the merchants. Okay. Traffic looks like it's okay. Maybe that was a fluke. Let's try it for a few days. Let's try it for a week. And by the time you're done, the merchants are like, if you don't pedestrianize Times Square, we're going to kill you because we're going to lose a fortune.
So like, there's all these great stories like Paris and Montreal, the ones I go to, but like Paris used the pandemic to basically say these streets are going to be closed and we're going to let people walk and bike on them because they get outside and get exercise. It's important. And then like, everyone's like, yeah, we love this. And then when like the world was coming back to like more normality, they're like, oh, yeah, we're going to keep some of these closed. It was like, boo, fuck you. We're going to kill you. We hate this mayor. And they went, well, I'm just going to do it anyway. We've already tested it. It works. We're going to keep doing it. And then a year later, it's like, we'd like to re-elect you with an enhanced majority. Montreal has the same stories of like the plateau was, we're going to take that street and turn it from a two-way street to a one-way street. And we're going to extend the sidewalk and we're going to plant some more trees. And people were like, but like my commute doesn't work now. I can't drive. Like, how does this work? And then over time, they're like, well, more people are out walking and more people or kids are playing. And the trees mean that the street is kept shadier and cooler in the summer. And again, it went from like death threats for harming a few things to why can't we do more of these streets like this? Okay, we'll do more re-election with a bigger mandate. And like, it's that sort of thing of like, you're right. You don't have to go like big bang, let's change it all overnight. But it's like, just keep nudging it in the direction and then take advantage of events as the world changes around you and you have the momentum for it. But it all comes from doing, right? You have to do something.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, and you know, it's actually like, and you know, I'm by the way, as somebody who works in Texas, that's the only thing that I will use New York City as an example for. Right. So that you can do something that extreme. You know, you're in Toronto. So if I were in Toronto, I'd be looking at more at New York or Paris or whatever other place you said is as Montreal. Like I would see that more as peers. You know, I'm doing some work in Fort Worth. I've done some work in Dallas, but I work in a lot of smaller towns. So I try not to view places that are radically different, you know, as fundamentally as case studies. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, these are also very global lessons, right? These are also lessons that can be applied to a bunch of other places. And in my own experience, you know, no matter where you are, it's like there's certain things that humans will enjoy and there's certain things that you can do that they will have positive experiences. So, for example, one of the things that I found that I saw in Deep Ellum, but I've also seen in a lot of other places, you know, but Deep Ellum was the best example of that. This Crowdist project where it's like, if you give spaces to people that have some flexibility, they will use it in ways that astound you. And in this project in Deep Ellum, all sorts of things happen. One of the first things that happened is, you know, we had to hire a security person, an off-duty cop, basically, for this whole event, right? That was a lot of the budget. So this guy comes out and he's selling cotton candy in very kind of traditional Mexican attire, right? And he's selling cotton candy and like the cop goes to me, she's like, do you want me to get rid of this guy? I'm like, no, like, this is awesome. And so, you know, for the whole time there, this guy was selling cotton candy and people were performing and people were using the space and people, like all of these cases, it's like you've given this space to people and it's like they're using it in this creative way. And it's like you're programming, but you're not over-programming it. You're leaving flexibility. The Corsicana, where I recently worked, but I was kind of a sub on a larger team that did some work there in 2017. Which is this place where it's the first place that the Storefront Renaissance League worked. It was the original Western oil town. So it's the first place where they discovered oil west of the Mississippi, Corsicana, Texas. And it's about an hour from Dallas. You can imagine the quality of buildings that it has, and you just the size of the downtown and the sort of leftovers of the wealth. But we literally went over there and we did this big bulb out. We just put out cones, put out plants. It was an intersection where we saw that if it were shorter, it would feel safer, it would feel more comfortable. The cars would slow down a little bit. So we did this thing as a test and did this thing explaining it. And it started being used. Ironically, we actually got reused by a car, but in a more human-oriented way. Somebody had this like classic car that they were showing off, and they ended up putting it into the bulb out and showing off the car in the bulb out. It's something that we didn't predict. I remember in Grand Prairie, Texas, we did this event and we had some music on. It was just like a long day. We were just like, well, you know, you do a special event sometimes. I don't know if you've run a lot of them, but you just get usually into a point in like at 3 p.m. where people stop showing up and you're like, what are we doing with this exhausting event? But there was some music and these kids ended up taking over the music. It's like, okay. And then they do this like synchronized dance. And there were these kids ranging from what it looked like from, you know, 5 to 16 doing a synchronized dance thing out on the floor. And you had like 9 kids doing this dance. We didn't expect that. In fact, in the example that I gave in New York, when they shut down, when they pedestrianized Times Square, they had a list of 200 activities that they expected might happen that people might do. One of the things that was not on that list was a snowball fight. It snowed unexpectedly and people organized into teams and had a snowball fight in an area that had been for cars normally.
Yeah.
Right? It's like they'll just astound you. I remember, so here's an extreme example. I was in Hearst, Texas, and I did some events there at a strip shopping center where we were kind of demonstrating use as a public space in this. And so we had this musician who was hired, and within the same strip shopping center, there was also this dance troupe that was like kind of like a hip hop dance troupe or some type of vibe like that. And a lot of the people were there because there was this community theater that was the largest community theater in Texas, where you had a lot of them that were like watching their kids do community theater. So you had like these like really suburban theater moms who were like the majority of the audience who was there. You had this guy who was playing an acoustic guitar. And then you had a bunch of people who showed up from like this hip hop dance place that just started breaking out into dance. And there's no way these theater moms would ever, and theater parents, would have ever seen like this type of hip hop dance performance. And then they certainly would have seen it to someone playing like an acoustic guitar, right? Like, and like he ended up changing his music to adjust to it. So it was like this really cool experience. I'm like, this is a strip suburban shopping center, but this is like what you might call, like, this would be a cool experience if you saw it in Toronto, right? Like, this would be amazing. And it was like, because you created a space for people and you added in flexibility and people did something with it.
So you talk about like the examples of small towns in Texas and doing a lot of work there. When you're doing that work in a small town, thinking about like third places, thinking about like these developments, especially in the context of strip developments, where do you look for inspiration? Where do you go to and go like, those are the examples that like we're aspiring to here, is maybe not to copy them, but to like, this is where we can take our inspiration.
Yeah, well, you know, I get case studies from a lot of different contexts, and I've been to about, I think maybe 200 towns in Texas, right? So I think that there ends up not necessarily, and I would add that when I started this, there weren't necessarily a lot of really great case studies in similar towns in Texas, so we had to kind of get what we could out of it. Now, there are certain places that I especially respect. So I talk a lot about, for example, Sulphur Springs, Texas. And one of the reasons why I bring them up all the time, probably people who have listened to a bunch of my podcasts might be sick of hearing about them, but they're a place that really started early on and really had a belief in themselves and that have, you know, pushed past their weight, where you have a place, you know, that isn't that big, that has maybe 16,000 people, but that has maybe, you know, 18 restaurants in its downtown. And a lot of what I saw there was as simple as a focus on public space where they had, you know, maybe 250 events a year, but also just a lot of persistence. But I think that, you know, ultimately, I see it as a mixture of places. And in some cases, even seen lessons that have come from larger places that I've seen brought into smaller places. So, for example, if you look at Austin, Austin is a place that has limited urbanism in the traditional sense in terms of the built form, but that has done things with food trucks and micro vendors and other things that have really filled in the spaces that they've inspired a lot of smaller places to think very similarly to them. I also look to a lot of existing traditions. For example, if you go to many of the small towns, especially if they're pretty thriving, what you see is a bunch of different uses that are under one roof that happen very informally. So you go into a lot of places and there's like a general store, but they also have a coffee place, but also they maybe do, you know, nails or something in the back. And I've seen that as a lot of inspiration and have built on it. And I've seen places like, you know, the town of Tyler, Texas, which is east of Austin, that has taken a school and adaptively reused it and kind of combined a lot of that creativity. So certainly I keep on top of greater trends and see a lot of things that have happened, you know, nationally. Like I keep on top of like, oh, here's kind of what the tactical urbanism movement has done, or here's some examples of case studies from strong towns. But I think that, you know, the main principle is like every place is different, but the needs are how do we fill in spaces, or how do we take spaces that are underutilized or that are kind of overused by cars and give them to people? And I think it ends up being, I wouldn't say that there's one dominant place that's been an inspiration from me, but just kind of taking things from different contexts and seeing how they work where I am. I've ended up working in a lot of places where I haven't, you know, where there hasn't been like a lot of direct case studies. Like I think of like Portland, Texas, where I came in and was like, Portland, Texas is across the bridge from Corpus Christi. They had a grid of streets a long time ago, but like when they would have formed into a traditional downtown, kind of hurricanes hit. So they were never a downtown. They had like a grid and they had like a bunch of uses, but they never had something formulated to a downtown. I was never able to find a perfect case study for that. So I kind of had to look and say like, well, what are the principles and how can we apply it to this place and what type of analysis can we use? And I've ended up in a lot of situations like that. People call me when they have a problem that other people aren't necessarily enthusiastic about solving and see if I'll pour some passion into it, if that makes sense.
When you're doing this in Texas, how often do you look outside of, because I think it's one of these things of urbanists love to go, oh my God, that town in Europe was so cute. Like, I wish we had this at home. But you can't go take in, I don't know, Priano or like cute little towns in Montereggio or whatever in Italy and apply it to the Texas context. It just doesn't work. But like, is there a way that you can go and take some things that are so like quite radically different and apply it to that Texan landscape?
I think that there's principles that are universal that you can apply. And I haven't in recent years traveled as much as I would have liked to, you know, kind of globally, right? But I honestly, I'm more interested in the direct application of the places where I normally work so far. I'm more interested in seeing what they're doing in Australia and New Zealand, for example, than what they're doing in Europe, because they're doing very amazing placemaking there under basically very similar conditions urbanistically to what we have here. Very car-dependent places, places that grew the most, you know, that got wealthy after World War II and grew the most, and where there's plenty of land and plenty of room to sprawl. And, you know, what I've seen there is that they've been very serious about placemaking efforts. And I see them as, in terms of the way that they're built, peers that we could learn a lot for under the conditions that we're in, where it's like, okay, here's this city that hasn't really been, you know, that was kind of built for the car, that, you know, maybe at one point before World War II had three blocks that weren't built for the car. And, you know, how do we work with what we have, or how do we work in this kind of suburban context? I think that I would love to find the bandwidth to travel more globally again. I've done a little bit of Europe, not much. But I would love to do that and see what lessons can be pulled. And I'm sure there's a lot. I also think that I'm probably going to be working in a lot more context based on conversations I've had. So I think that will open my horizon. So I would love to open my horizons, but I think fundamentally, you know, I'll see a lot of discussion where it's like, people will say things like, well, people talk about Paris's cycling infrastructure, but Paris wasn't Paris even, you know, 5 years ago, and it's like, yeah, it was Paris. Like it was Paris. It was very, you know, making Paris a cycling friendly city, you know, or even like, well, at one point, you know, the Netherlands were like our city. No, they weren't. You know, this was around much, much different. Like even like, so yeah, you know, can we learn in a community in Texas from what they did in Amsterdam? Sure. But can we copy it? No, like yeah. it's not the same context. And I think that you have to work with who you are and what you are and what you have.
So if you had this magic wand, which I'd love to end these conversations on, because I could go on all day with you, Rick, and we'd chat a lot, but like there's so much good stuff in here. If you had a magic wand and like going about whether that's doing something in a smaller town in Texas, whether it's doing something in a bigger city, whether it's doing something like more broadly, what would your wish or your command be with the magic wand?
When I talk to a city that has the leadership that understands that you have to work from the ground up and that you have to work with what you have and that you need to take the next steps, it feels like a magic wand. And I've said to them, there's some people who have spoken to our leaders who have said, can I just copy you and put you in every town in Texas? So if I had a magic wand, every town and city in Texas would have leadership that says, you know, in their economic development and city level and et cetera, that says, where do we start and what can we do now with what we really have? That would be amazing to me. And I'd never be short of work ever again either.
I love that. None of us would
be very well employed. What?
None of us would be. I love that. That's the perspective.
None of us would be. No, you get the right leadership, and you know, and it's just like the way that these practices are. I think you know you have to judge a tree by its fruits, and you can see these results. And you know, and I think what I was saying before, I think a lot we've gone a little bit back and forth in the conversation, so I think I lost it. But like. We have these grandiose means, but then the ends that we have, we don't even know what we're trying to do. It's like take the simple means, but try to get amazing results out of it. Like try to have a place where your children want to go back to and where like people have experience that they're going to tell their grandchildren about, like that people will come and fall in love with. That's your means. And you can take simple things and work toward that. And that's exciting to me.
I love that. What a great note to end on.
Awesome, Ian. Thanks so much for having me, man.
Rick, that was a joy. Thanks so much.
Okay, appreciate it. Take care, sir.
There we go. Hope you enjoyed that one. Thanks again for getting this far. As always, these things are really, really helped if you can like it, share it, review it, do all the things that make them go further, farther, better, faster, whatnot. And then next up, we'll probably do something on transit, and I think we got something on trees. So stay tuned for more of these. Thanks.